content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 23rd, 2014 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. U.S. joins hunt for missing Nigerian schoolgirls. What happened? Drones, manned spy planes, and intelligence agents from the U.S. and the U.K. and other Western nations were deployed to Nigeria this week in a bid to help locate about 275 Nigerian schoolgirls being held hostage by Islamist militants Boko Haram in a remote region of the country. A video released Monday showed around 100 of the girls wearing full veils and praying. The group's leader, Abu Bakar Shekau, claimed they had converted to Islam and threatened to sell them into slavery unless the government released 4,000 Boko Haram prisoners. "There is a market for selling humans," he said. "Allah says I should sell." Nigerian government officials said they had opened talks with Boko Haram leaders. Throughout the world, there was growing outrage over the kidnapping, which took place a month ago at a boarding school in Nigeria's northeast state of Borno. A Twitter campaign, hashtag Bring Back Our Girls, went viral. Boko Haram, which translates as Western Education is Forbidden, was set up to establish an Islamic state governed by Sharia law. But when Shekau took the reins in 2009, he made it much more radical. His men have killed an estimated 7,000 people in the past 2 years alone, including Muslims he deemed too secular. "He seems to want to distinguish himself by the depth of his brutality," said former U.S. counterterrorism chief Daniel Benjamin. "It is a big part of his calling card." What the editorial said: this kidnapping has brought Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan under an international spotlight, said The Economist, and he doesn't look good. For several years, Jonathan has publicly shrugged off the deaths of thousands of people at the hands of Boko Haram, saying there is little he can do about such fanatics. 2 weeks passed before he even commented on the girls' kidnapping. Nigeria's army clearly isn't up to the task of rescuing the girls either. It was reportedly warned of the kidnapping 4 hours in advance and has a reputation for incompetence and brutality. "With each day that passes, the job of finding these poor girls gets more complicated," said the New York Post. "Intelligence reports suggest that many of them have been separated into smaller groups and are being hidden in the caves of the Gwoza Mountains and the dense Sambisa Forest. But it's imperative that the U.S. doesn't dismiss this as merely a local problem. In recent years, terrorists have struck all over Africa, from a gas plant in Algeria to a shopping mall in Kenya. Any Islamist war on modernity will sooner or later target America." What the columnist said: for now, Shekau definitely has the upper hand, said Christopher Dickey in the DailyBeast.com. The Nigerian government is under a huge amount of pressure to act, so he can set his ransom price very high indeed. And with the girls scattered around in different areas, any military operation to free a few would endanger the many. "A dramatic rescue attempt might play well on TV," said Richard Dowden in CNN.com, "but it wouldn't solve the deeper problem, Nigeria's dysfunction. Thanks to its oil riches, the country recently overtook South Africa to become Africa's biggest economy. Yet Borno State remains one of the poorest, most neglected parts of the planet. This makes it the perfect recruiting ground for Boko Haram. To weaken terrorism's appeal, the West must pressure Jonathan's government to clamp down on corruption and invest some of its oil funds in schools and hospitals. The broader war on terrorism will require more than that, said Ayan Hirsi Ali in the Wall Street Journal. It is time for Western liberals to wake up and recognize that Boko Haram is not an aberration and that its persecution of women is not an isolated tragedy. A new wave of extremism is spreading among young men throughout the Muslim world, in Nigeria, Yemen, Pakistan, and beyond. And the goals of these homegrown jihadists are to cleanse their nations of Western culture and to deny women their most basic rights, including education. The West and moderate Muslims need to do more, much more, to combat this dangerous ideology, or it will continue to spread. The vote to split Ukraine. Ukraine took another step toward disintegration this week as pro-Russian separatists held referendums on self-rule in two eastern regions and proclaimed an overwhelming, if highly suspect, victory. Almost 90% of voters in the Donetsk region and 98% in neighboring Luhansk voted for greater autonomy. But the ballots were marred by numerous irregularities. Many voters couldn't reach voting stations because of rebel and government roadblocks. There were no election monitors outside of the militants who arranged and counted the votes. And the Ukrainian military said it intercepted cars containing box loads of pre-marked ballots. While Western governments refused to recognize the vote, the Kremlin issued a statement saying it respects the will of the people, but did not answer separatist pleas that Russia now annex the Donetsk region. Putin doesn't need to annex eastern Ukraine, said The Economist, because he's already got most of what he wanted. Crimea is once again part of Mother Russia. Kiev's pro-Western leadership will think twice before again daring to defying the Kremlin. And by standing up to the West, Putin raised his popularity at home and freed Russians from a nagging inferiority complex. But the Russia strongman's hand is not all aces, said the New York Times in an editorial. There's a gathering rumble of violence in Ukraine that even Putin might not be able to control. Six government soldiers were killed in an ambush in the east this week, and the self-declared people's governor of Luhansk was injured in a suspected assassination attempt. And while Putin recently said he favored postponing the referendums, the rebels held them anyway, which suggests that events are already developing a momentum of their own. Putin wanted those votes to go ahead, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. The overwhelming show of support for self-rule, fraudulent or not, will only intensify the pressure on Kiev to negotiate with pro-Russian agitators who have taken power in the east and to cede them greater autonomy, thereby undermining Ukraine's sovereignty. If only the leaders of the West were half as clever in trying to contain the Russian strongman. While Putin is playing geopolitical chess like a grandmaster, his opponents are playing checkers. On the subject of Putin, here is an interesting editorial from Thanis Bates, one of the editors of the Week magazine. Planet Earth cannot contain Vladimir Putin's territorial ambitions. A mere 45 years after Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, Russia's government has now unveiled plans to go one step further and set up a permanently manned Russian colony on the lunar surface by 2030. This process has a beginning but no end, declared Russian Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin. We are coming to the moon forever. Russia, which now builds the world's most robust and reliable spacecraft, really might be the first nation to put a manned colony on the moon. China doesn't have the technological know-how, Its Jade Rabbit rover broke down a few weeks after landing on the moon in December, with government scientists blaming the mechanical failings on frostbite. The U.S. has lost its ambitions in space. President Obama scrapped NASA's plan to put a man back on the moon by 2020, saying it was too expensive. It might be galling for Americans to see cosmonauts stomping across their old turf, but we should cheer on the Kremlin nonetheless, because the moon could provide a new and less dangerous outlet for Russian nationalism. By aiming for the heavens, Putin could satisfy his desire for imperialist land grabs and distract his people from their sclerotic economy, all without invading any more former Soviet republics. Vladimir's excellent adventure could also provide the entire planet with entertainment. Surely he wouldn't be able to resist the opportunity to play spaceman and have his picture taken as he triumphantly plants a Russian flag in the Sea of Tranquility. Better that Russia's banner flies over that cold, dead rock than over Kiev, Riga, or Warsaw. And under the "it wasn't all bad" heading, a new educational program that uses online video chatting to connect American seniors with Brazilian students hoping to practice their English has proved a big hit. Residents of the Windsor Park Retirement Community in Chicago listened patiently, occasionally correcting grammar, as the young Brazilians share details of their lives. The seniors are eager to find new folks to chat with, and most have never met anybody from Brazil. "It's a simple idea," said Joanna Monteiro of FCB Brazil, the company behind the service. "It's exciting to see their reaction. It truly benefits both sides." We'll take a look now at our controversy of the week. Climate change. Will the world face reality? Far too many Americans see climate change as either a liberal hoax or a distant threat, said the New York Times in an editorial. But no one who reads the new National Climate Assessment can possibly think that way any longer. Climate change, says the 300 leading scientists who researched and wrote the report for the White House, has moved firmly into the present, with the U.S. already experiencing longer, hotter summers, shorter winters, rising sea levels, and more prolonged droughts. The future will bring far more serious disruptions. The West will be hit with hotter heat waves, rampaging wildfires, lower crop yields, and perpetual water shortages. Rising sea levels will inundate South Florida and many coastal communities in the East. With hundreds of pages of detailed evidence and analysis, the report leaves no doubt that climate change is going to have profound and far-reaching impacts on essentially every aspect of human life, says Phil Platt in Slate.com. Let's hope this alarming wake-up call finally pierces the conservative bubble of climate change denial. The heat is on. Actually, said Stephen Hayward in WSJ.com, the NCA is not nearly as dire as its cheerleaders suggest. Yes, there is some new data here on how our climate is changing, but the evidence that those changes are human-caused is still far from definitive. That won't matter to the liberal media, of course, which is already busy using this report for its intended purpose, generating alarming headlines to scare the public into supporting President Obama's push for more bureaucratic control over the energy sector. This report is the essence of demagoguery, said WashingtonExaminer.com. The White House is now blatantly using scare tactics to extend its control over where and how people live, work, and play. Mother Nature's the one using scare tactics, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. This week, scientists reported that the West Antarctic ice sheet has begun to collapse, which will eventually lead to a catastrophic sea level rise of 12 feet. Are we going to let the climate craziness of the self-deluded right stop the U.S. from responding to a disaster that's already becoming visible? Conservatives can be skeptical of scientists who clamor for a strict global regulatory regime, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, but not of the scientific data itself. It's absurd to believe that virtually all climate scientists, encompassing the national academies of more than two dozen countries, are conspiring in a massive hoax on humanity. But even if warming is real, said Robert Samuelson, also in the Post, the scientists fail to mention one key fact. We have no solution. To stop climate change in its tracks, climate experts say, we'd need 40% reduction in overall emissions. But China, India, and the developing world are more concerned about lifting their populations out of poverty than saving the polar ice caps. As a result, global emissions are projected to increase nearly 50% in coming decades. So whatever the U.S. does will make little difference. The only real hope is to find a new technology that produces energy as cheaply as fossil fuels, but with no carbon emissions. If governments focused on the need for innovation rather than restrictions, conservatives might be less skeptical, and that approach would have the added virtue of being honest. And it was a good week for staying out of the gulag after Russian President Vladimir Putin scored 6 goals and had 5 assists in an exhibition hockey game in Sochi. Although hockey is a notoriously physical game, no opponent laid a finger on Putin as he fired the puck at will. It was a good week for the name Noah, which the Social Security Administration announced was the nation's most common baby boy name in 2013, ending Jacob's 14-year run. Sophia was the most popular name for baby girls for the third year running. It was a good week for aggressive outreach after Pope Francis said that if an expedition of green aliens with big ears showed up at the Vatican, he'd gladly convert them to Catholicism. Who are we to close doors? The Pope said. It was a bad week for romance after male students at a California high school were caught running a draft for prom dates that ranked females and allowed boys to pay as much as $140 for a first-round pick. A lot of the girls respect the draft, said a student, and stick with those dates. It was a bad week for safety tips. After Brazilian police published a guide for visitors to next month's World Cup, instructing them not to scream if they are mugged, so their robbery doesn't turn into a murder. It was a bad week for false confidence after a new YouGov poll found that only 4% of Americans think they are less intelligent than the average person. I'll have to think about that one. And we like to highlight North Carolina folks when we can. This short blurb from Only in America. A North Carolina woman called the 911 emergency line to report that Subway had given her a flatbread pizza made with marinara sauce instead of a pizza sauce. It's terrible, and I got my receipt, Bevalenti Hall, age 37, told 911 operators. I can't eat that kind of sauce. She was arrested and charged with misuse of the 911 system. Over on the briefing page, India's religious divide. Narendra Modi, a Hindu nationalist, is likely to become India's next prime minister. Why is the Muslim minority so worried? What is Modi's background? Brash and charismatic, Modi, 63, is the most powerful person in Gujarat state, where he has built a cult of personality. As a young man, he joined the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, RSS, a Hindu paramilitary group that champions Hindutva, the belief that Hinduism is the true culture of India and should guide its way of life. The group's political wing is the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP. Modi moved from RSS to BJP in the 1980s and rose quickly through the party ranks. In 2001, the party appointed him chief minister of Gujarat. Since then, the state's economy has boomed, growing at a rate of 10% a year, and its people have better access to power and water than ever before. On the strength of those successes, Modi has become head of the BJP. If the party wins a plurality of seats in the national election that concluded this week, as expected, Modi will become prime minister of the world's second most populous nation. But that prospect alarms many of India's 175 million Muslims. What do they have against Modi? He presided over Gujarat in 2002 when Hindu mobs slaughtered 800 Muslims in a pogrom of astonishing brutality. For more than a decade prior to that confrontation, Gujarat's Hindus and Muslims had engaged in a bitter dispute over a 16th century mosque in the state. BJP leaders said it had been built on the site of the Hindu god Ram's birthplace and was thus an affront that should be removed. In 1992, tens of thousands of Hindu nationalists descended on the mosque and destroyed it, sparking deadly riots throughout India. In 2002, Hindus were preparing to dedicate a new temple to Ram at the site, when a fight broke out between Hindu activists and Muslims at a train station. During the ensuing riot, a fire later deemed accidental engulfed a train filled with activists, and 59 Hindus were burned to death, including women and children. Hindu nationalists believed the burning of the train was a deliberate atrocity, and they took vengeance on the entire Muslim population. Well-organized Hindu mobs slaughtered some 800 people, burned thousands of homes, and destroyed more than 300 mosques. Women were raped and then skewered. Even babies were doused with gas and burned alive. In the aftermath, some 150,000 Muslims fled Gujarat. What was Modi's role? Official investigations have cleared him of actively supporting the slaughter. But Modi did nothing to stop it, and there's evidence he may have tacitly approved the violence. Investigations by Human Rights Watch and other outside groups found that the mobs weren't randomly attacking, but rather choosing targets from official lists of Muslim businesses, homes, and mosques. The police refused to respond to Muslim pleas for help, and officers have testified that Modi ordered them directly not to interfere with the mobs. A prominent Muslim politician, Ehsan Jafri, phoned Modi and other officials for help and was told police would come to escort him to safety. Instead, a mob of thousands besieged Jafri's building, hurling firebombs. When he refused to swear allegiance to Ram, they stripped him, cut off his fingers, then his hands, then his feet, and dragged him through the streets, finally killing him. What happened afterward? Modi's popularity soared in Gujarat, as he was seen as having restored Hindu honor and put Muslims in their place. The following year, his party was overwhelmingly reelected. In later years, Modi's local government tried to block national government investigations into the Gujarat riots, and it has charged officials who cooperate with the inquiry with violating the state's Official Secrets Act. For years, Modi himself refused to discuss the riots. In 2013, as the election campaign began, he made a bizarre apology, tweeting, "I am truly sorry that so many puppies were run over while I was driving the car." Later adding, "Even though I wasn't really driving, I was in the back seat." What does Modi say now? He says India must put 2002 behind it, and as an olive branch to Muslims, the BJP promises to promote Muslim education and restore heritage sites. But Modi's main message is economic, and he says he will do for India's growth and modernization what he did for Gujarat's. He is also representing himself as a self-made man, in contrast to his main election rival, Rahul Gandhi of the Congress Party, a scion of India's most established and politically connected family. Yet at the same time, Modi has been whipping up sentiment against Muslim immigrants from Bangladesh, saying, "The infiltrators have to go." Many Muslims and other religious minorities do not trust Modi's assurances that he will be the leader of all Indians. "Everyone says that Modi is a good leader who built roads and bridges," said Rupa Modi, who witnessed the 2002 massacre in Gujarat. "Those roads are built on dead bodies." Here's one of the best columns from the U.S. this week. "When Profits Conflict with U.S. Interests," from Harold Meyerson at the Washington Post. "How should the U.S. deal with Russian President Vladimir Putin's aggression?" asked Harold Meyerson. "America's multinational companies agree. Ignore it. Since Russia is a trading partner, big corporations actively oppose broadening the economic sanctions that are the West's main leverage over Putin. Russia is Pepsi's second largest market. Boeing sells planes to Russia's airlines, and Cargill has more than 3,000 employees there. The list goes on and on. European corporations are also adamantly opposed to toughening up the sanctions. This should be a wake-up call for conservatives who simultaneously worship the free market and blame President Obama for not taking stronger steps against Putin. In a globalized economy, corporate interests no longer match and often actively oppose our national interests and America's ideals of freedom and democracy. Big business could care less that China imprisons dissidents and censors its media, or that Mideast oil kingdoms have no religious freedom, or that sending millions of jobs abroad has gutted our middle class. The free market is utterly amoral. Conservatives should want more from a deity than that." Here's a column from the United Kingdom. Rod Little at the Sunday Times, "Why We Are Worked Up About Halal." "The British people are aghast to learn that they've been unwittingly eating halal meat," said Rod Little. "A series of tabloid exposés has revealed that the vast majority of the cows, chickens, and sheep that go into our fast food and almost every packaged or frozen meal have been slaughtered according to Islamic rite. That means the animals have their throats slit while a Muslim reads from the Quran and some other bloke burns the Israeli flag and 40 black-clad women ululate or something. It doesn't affect the taste, so why do we care? Some say they're outraged over animal welfare issues, but that's unlikely given the almost total lack of concern we show about all the other ghastly treatment meted out to the stuff that ends up on our plates. Besides, about 80% of halal animals are stunned before being bled. And Christianity doesn't take a position on whether we eat halal or kosher or vegan or paleo, so it's not like it's against our religion. I think it is simply that an awful lot of people resent the speed at which our country is changing. that the major food companies routinely use meat slaughtered according to Islamic custom is just another sign that we no longer live in the England of our youth, or an England of the English. From the International Columns, here's a piece on South Sudan, a young country falls apart. Is South Sudan preparing for a descent into hell? Asked Andrew Brown in the Cape Times, South Africa. The mostly black tribes there gained independence from the Arab-led government of Sudan in 2011 after more than two decades of civil war, and peace was supposed to be at hand. Now genocide threatens. Civil war broke out in December when, the accepted storyline goes, President Salva Kiir, an ethnic Dinka, accused his former vice president, Riek Machar, a Nuer, of plotting a coup. The reality is different. This was no spontaneous explosion of lingering animosities, but planned aggression on the part of the government and a vicious counterattacked by Nuer soldiers. Kiir was plotting to purge the army of Nuer troops, and when the Nuer caught wind of it, they retaliated. Clashes have raged since then, and ordinary South Sudanese are victims once again. It looks like a tribal conflict, but this is just cynical politics, said David Dow in the Sudan Times. Leaders on both sides have taken advantage of their largely illiterate communities to hide their political aspirations. At bottom, though, there is none of the ethnic hatred that has plagued other countries. In Kenya, for example, husbands and wives of different tribes turned on one another after the last election. Nothing like that happened in South Sudan. And if the two sides can abide by a recent U.S. brokered ceasefire, peace will come. That agree won't hold because the U.S. was never the right broker for this conflict, said Al-Ayam in an editorial. The Obama administration only got involved because it feels a guilt complex over its role in splitting our country in two. The U.S. convinced itself that the North was the sole cause of the South's problems, and never stopped for a minute to consider the real condition in the South until they exploded in its face. We Sudanese are the ones who understand the South, and it is we who should lead the talks. Sudan is actually fueling this conflict, said News24.com. Independent observers report that Khartoum is supplying both sides with arms and ammunition, which is the only reason Machar's ragtag rebel army has been able to keep fighting for 5 months. The longer the two sides fight, of course, the less stable the infant country will be, and the more Sudan will feel tempted to intervene on supposedly humanitarian grounds and reclaim the ore-rich lands it lost in 2011. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is losing hope. If the conflict continues, he said, half of South Sudan's 12 million people will either be displaced internally, refugees abroad, starving, or dead by the year's end. And we'll go ahead and turn over to the last word. Into the wild darkness. In nature, death is not a defeat, says Eva Solitis, but that's a hard comfort as I confront my own. For 26 Septembers, I've hiked up streams littered with corpses of dying humpbacked salmon. It is nothing new, nothing surprising, not the stench, not the gore, not the thrashing of black humpies plowing past their dead brethren to spawn and die. It is familiar, still, it is terrible and wild. Winged and furred predators gather at the mouths of the streams to pounce, pluck, tear, rip, and plunder the living, dying hordes. This September, it is just as terrible and wild as ever. But I gather in the scene with different eyes, the eyes of someone whose own demise is no longer an abstraction, the eyes of someone who has experienced the tears, rips, and plunder of cancer treatment. In spring, I learned my breast cancer had come back, had metastasized to the pleura of my right lung. Metastatic breast cancer is incurable. Through its prism, I now see the world. I'm not a salmon biologist. I don't hike salmon streams as part of my job. I hike up streams and bear trails and muskegs and mountains for pleasure. The work my husband Craig and I do each field season in Prince William Sound is sedentary. We study whales. For weeks at a stretch, we live on a 34-foot boat far from any town, often out of cell phone and internet range. We sit for hours on the flying bridge with binoculars or a camera pressed to our eyes. Periodically, we climb down the ladder and walk a few paces to the cabin to retrieve the orca or humpback catalog, to drop the hydrophone, or to grab fresh batteries, mugs of hot soup or tea, or granola bars. We climb back up. We get wet, we get cold, we get bored. Sometimes we even get sunburned. We eat, sleep, and work on the boat. Hikes are our sanity, our maintenance. We hike because we love this rainy, lush, turbulent-breathing, expiring, windy place as much as we love our work with whales. Normally, September is the beginning of the end of our field season, which starts most years in April or May. But for me, this year, it's just the beginning. And conversely, like everything else in my life since I learned cancer had come back, it's tinged with the prescience of ending. The median survival for a person with metastatic breast cancer is 26 months. Some people live much longer. Will this be my last field season? Will the chemo drug I'm taking subdue the cancer into long-term remission? Will I be well enough to work on the boat next summer? Will I be alive? A summer of tests and procedures and doctor appointments kept me off the boat until now. A surgery and 6-day hospitalization in early August to prevent fluid from building up in my pleural space taught me that certain experiences cut us off entirely from nature, or seem to. I know that as long as we inhabit bodies of flesh, blood, and bone, we are wholly inside nature. But under medical duress, we forget this. Flesh, blood, and bone notwithstanding, a body hooked by way of tubes to suction devices by way of an IV to a synthetic morphine pump forgets its organic animal self. In the hospital, I learned to fear something more than death. Existence dependent upon technology, machines, sterile procedures, hoses, pumps, chemicals easing one kind of pain only to feed a psychic other. Existence apart from dirt, mud, muck, wind gust, crow call, fishy orca breath, bog musk, deer track, rain squall, bear scat. The whole ordeal was a necessary palliation, a stint of suffering to grant me long-term physical freedom, and yet it smacked of the way people too often spend their last days alive, and it really scared me. Ultimately, what I faced those hospital nights, what I face every day, is death impending. The other side, the passing over into the big unknown, what poet Harold Brodkey called his wild darkness, what poet Christian Wiman calls his bright abyss. Death may be the wildest thing of all, the least tamed or known phenomenon our consciousness has to reckon with. I don't understand how to meet it, not yet, maybe never. Can I take comfort in the countless births and deaths this earth enacts each moment? The jellyfish, the barnacles, the orcas, the salmon, the fungi, the trees, much less the humans. I woke this morning to the screech of gulls at the stream mouth. We'd anchored in Sleepy Bay for the night, a cove wide open to the strait where we often find orcas. The humpback salmon, millions returned this summer, a record run, are all up the creeks now. Before starting our daily search, Craig and I kayaked to shore. As we approached, I watched the gulls, dozens of them launching from the sloping beach where the stream branches into rivulets and pours into the bay. They wheeled and dipped over our heads, then quickly settled again to their grim task, plucking at faded salmon carcasses scattered all over the stones. The stench of a salmon stream in September is a cloying muck of rot, waste, ammonia. This is in-your-face death. Death without palliation or mercy or intervention. At the same time, it is enlivening, feeding energy to the gulls, bears, river otters, eagles, and the invisible decomposers who break the carcasses down to just bones and scales, which winter then erases. In spring, I kneel and drink from the same stream's clear, cold water, or plunge my head into it. It is snowmelt and rain filtered through alpine tundra, avalanche chute, muskeg, fen, and bog. It is water newly born, fresh, alive, and oxygenated, rushing over clean stones, numbing my skin. After we dragged the kayaks above the tide line, Craig wandered down the beach to retrieve a 5-gallon bucket he'd spotted and left me alone at the stream mouth. Normally, I am nervous about bears, but this time I walked up the stream toward the woods without singing or calling out. I stood on the bank and watched the birth-death spectacle. When Craig joined me, I uttered this platitude. We have separated ourselves so much from nature. I didn't say what I really meant. I rarely do these days. I fear most people, even those who love me best, would think me morbid if they could read my thoughts. Sometimes with Craig, I imagine he hears the words beneath my words, knows my mind, and then silence seems the best form of conversation. What I really meant was that despite the lack of palliation or mercy or intervention, I envied those salmon their raw deaths, not for a moment separated from nature, not even when dragged from their element by a bear. I know, dying of cancer in a bog would not look or sound pretty or peaceful. Hidden from view in this dream scene is the suffering, is the agony, is the needle and the morphine pump, unavailable to the salmon, eyeless in its wordless mouth, opening and closing, body swaying in its tattered, whitening skin. I don't by any means think constantly about dying. My reality is dual, 1 foot firmly in the living stream, the other on the gory bank. Life has become vivid and immediate these last months. No years of Buddhist meditation got me to this place. Just words on the phone. The cells were malignant. Later that day, after the crying, after the sitting mutely on the living room couch and staring out the window, Craig and I hauled a quilt into the backyard and lay down on the ground at the edge of the woods. We curled up, listening to wind in the birch trees. The frenetic din of territorial birds, staking their claims. Spring sprung on while we dozed off. Staying in the present moment isn't difficult when the alternative is dire. Unless imaginings of what might or might not come to pass. Useless imaginings of what might or might not come to pass. Craig and I hiked up the creek to where a path led into the forest, where blueberry bushes grew along margins of the bog. It wasn't a pleasant way to get there. The rocks were slick with decay, the water rushing and tea-colored from weeks of rain. The stink was thick as syrup, around us, unrelenting. I stepped around half-consumed corpses, curled and sloughing skin, their eyeless heads, headless flanks, brainless skulls, pearly backbones stripped of meat. As I crossed the creek, live humpies thumped my ankles, then battered themselves against rocks to get away. In their singular drive to spawn, they plowed right through eddies of bleached-out dead, as if that fate were not meant for them. Pico Iyer describes the charnel grounds along the banks of the Ganges in this way. Spirituality in Varanasi lies precisely in the poverty and sickness and death that it weaves into the unending tapestry. A place of holiness, it says, is not apart from the world, in a Shangri-La of calm, but a place where purity and filth, anarchy and ritual, unquenchable vitality, and the constant imminence of death all flow together. If there is spirituality in nature, it is in the sublime purity of wild roses and wild mushrooms in mossy woods, and the vitality of deer nibbling kelp on the beach, and the violet light of an oncoming storm, and equally in the anarchy and filth of the spawning grounds, in the undoctored reel of the ever-dying world. Facing death in a death-phobic culture is lonely, but in wild places like Prince William Sound or the woods and sloughs behind my house, it is different. The salmon dying in their stream tell me I am not alone. The evidence is everywhere. In the skull of an immature eagle I found in the woods, in the bones of a moose in the gully below my house, in the corpse of a wasp on the windowsill, in the fall of a birch leaf from its branch. These things tell me death is true, right, graceful, not tragic, not failure, not defeat. We have no dominion over what the world will do to us, all of us. What the earth will make of our tinkering and abuse can be modeled by computers, but is, in the end, beyond our reckoning, our science. Nature is not simply done to. Nature responds. Nature talks back. Nature is willful. We have no dominion over the wild darkness that surrounds us. It is everywhere. Under our feet, in the air we breathe, but we know nothing of it. We know more about the universe and the mind of an octopus than we do about death's true nature. Only that it is terrible and inescapable, and it is wild. Death is nature. Nature is far from over. In the end, the gore at the creek comforts more than it appalls. In the end, I must believe it, just like a salmon, I will know how to die, and though I die, though I lose my life, nature wins. Nature endures. It is strange, and it is hard, but it's comfort, and I'll take it. This story originally appeared in Orion magazine. Take a look now at the health and science page. Adding to the alphabet of life. From single-cell microbes to Homo sapiens, all species on Earth contain the same four-letter genetic code. But scientists working at the Scripps Research Institute have created an organism with two artificial additions to its genetic code, a breakthrough that may lead to new antibiotics, vaccines, and other innovations. The New York Times reports, natural DNA consists of four chemical units or nucleotides known by the letters A, C, G, and T, which bond to form the base pairs that combine to produce the amino acids and proteins that act as the building blocks of life. For the first time, scientists successfully inserted two synthetic nucleotides, dubbed X and Y, into the genome of the common E. coli bacterium. The cells then reproduced, passing the new genetic material on to the replicated cells. Whereas normal DNA produces 20 amino acids, the expanded DNA can make up to 172, raising the possibility of creating new proteins that function differently from those found in nature. These findings shed new light on the budding field of synthetic biology, wherein biological systems are created to perform specific medical or industrial functions. If you have a language that has a certain number of letters, said Scripps chemist Floyd Rommersberg, you want to add more letters so you can write more words and tell more stories. Training the immune system. Can extreme physical training alter a person's immune system? Researchers in the Netherlands sought to find out by putting a group of 12 men through a 10-day training regimen that included swimming in frigid water, lying bare-chested in the snow, and performing breathing exercises that mimicked hyperventilation. They then exposed the group, along with 12 non-trained subjects, to bacteria known to cause flu-like symptoms. The trained participants, who also did the breathing exercises while getting the shots, showed less inflammation and experienced fewer adverse symptoms than those who didn't train. The results, though preliminary, raise hopes for non-drug treatments to relieve the pain caused by inflammation in patients with autoimmune disorders, such as rheumatoid arthritis. Researchers say the breathing techniques are likely responsible for the bulk of the effect, as the trainees began producing more adrenaline, which suppresses the immune system, within 30 minutes of performing the exercises. The adrenaline levels were higher than in people who bungee jumped for the first time, Radboud University researcher Mathis Cox told LiveScience.com. Scientists caution that the training regimen should not be attempted without supervision. On the Talking Points page, the minimum wage, Seattle's big experiment. Brace for a re-engineering of the Seattle economy, said the Seattle Times in an editorial. While the nation debates raising the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, Seattle is among the growing number of municipalities and states that are going ahead on their own, and is now considering a plan to gradually raise the bottom pay rate to $15, among the highest in the country. If Mayor Ed Murray's proposal is approved by City Council as expected, the hike, 60% above Washington State's $9.32 minimum, may steeply increase the wages of workers in service industries, but it will also drive up prices for middle-class residents. The increase is just too big, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Businesses may decide to replace costly jobs with new technology, or they may move out to nearby suburbs. Seattle is about to turn itself into a gigantic laboratory, and the results may well be ugly. That's what McDonald's, Burger King, and some other businesses would like you to believe, said labor activists Arun Ivatri and Rebecca Smith in CNN.com. But the mayor's plan was approved by a committee that included 11 local businesses, which wouldn't have agreed to swallow such a pill voluntarily if they had bought predictions of business closures and mass layoffs. The mayor's committee closely studied the likely economic impact, said David Dian in Salon.com, and found that in other cities, businesses did not move, fire lots of workers, or close when the minimum wage was raised. Customers, meanwhile, would pay 42 cents more on a $10 lunch tab. That's hardly disastrous, especially since many new potential customers will have extra purchasing power to buy that lunch. Like it or not, the minimum wage is headed upward nearly everywhere, said Susan Adams in Forbes.com. Why? Because most Americans believe it should. A recent Gallup survey showed that 76% favored an increase to at least $9. More than 120 cities and 26 states have now raised their minimums to higher than $7.25, including 6 states this year. As momentum grows, Congress can't keep blocking President Obama's plan to hike the federal minimum to $10.10. A new federal minimum will be passed before President Obama's second term ends. And a few notes as we wind down our time together today. Cases of myopia or nearsightedness have rocketed as children across the world spend more time staring at computer screens. 1/4 of the world's population, or 1.6 billion people, now has the condition, and experts predict that by 2020, 1 in 3 people will be nearsighted. Irene Triplett receives a $73.13 pension payment from the U.S. government each month for her father's military service in the Civil War. The 84-year-old is the last child of any Civil War veteran on the benefits roll. There are still 16 widows and children of veterans of the 1898 Spanish-American War receiving military pensions, and 4,038 widows, sons, and daughters of World War I vets. On the poll watch, the public's view of Obamacare has improved since the news that 8 million people have signed up. 61% say they want Congress to either leave the Affordable Care Act alone or tweak the law to make it better. 38% say the law should be appealed. And a slightly humorous quote here as we finish up today, from actor John Barrymore, quoted in TheFix.com. He says, "Sex, the thing that takes up the least amount of time and causes the most amount of trouble." On that note, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.